This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The community of Hanford Village in Columbus, Ohio, is one of those neighborhoods that, when you walk its streets, you walk through more than 120 years of American history.
All the people out here were like a little village, and everybody knew everybody. And it was just like family. The house next door to where I grew up at, I knew more about their house than their own kids did. That's how close-knit we were.
Shirley Mixon is 72 years old. She's lived almost her entire life in Hanford Village, and she still lives just a few houses down from Hanford Village Park.
I remember as a child, you know, the park that I was talking about, they used to have baseball games on Saturdays and Friday and Sunday, and then they had a little, I would call it like a little food shack where they would sell, you know, hot dogs and stuff like that, just like you would see on TV in them old time, you know. Baseball games and stuff, that's the way it was.
Hanford Village is an historically black neighborhood. It was first incorporated in 1909 for newly arrived black Americans from the South who had journeyed to Ohio during the Great Migration. The community's heyday came almost 40 years later when it became home to one of the most storied squadrons in American history.
They built this community for the black airmen.
The Tuskegee Airmen.
They were pioneers. And no pioneer has it easy. They fought lies, they fought heartbreak, and they won.
The Tuskegee Airmen were the first black fighter and bomber pilots in U.S. military history. They flew in Europe and North Africa during World War II. And in 1946, after the close of the war, the airmen were relocated to what was then known as Lockburn Air Force Base near Columbus. The Federal Housing Administration provided funds to build homes for the veterans. A flyer from the period announces, quote, New Hanford Village, Negro War veterans, 146 homes are being built here for you to be purchased under the GI Bill of Rights for only $125 cash. Shirley Mixon still lives in one of the houses that was built in 1946. The community was segregated, she says, but she also remembers how vibrant and self-sufficient Hanford Village was through the 1950s.
We had our own town hall. We had our own mayor. We had our own police department. We had a little grocery store down there. We had three churches. We had a Holiness Church, a Methodist Church, and a Baptist Church that was out here. But it was like a community, you know.
So that's what Hanford Village was like for hundreds of black families for the better part of 50 years. What's it like now?
You can hear them trucks flying down. You can hear cars going down the freeway. You can hear them when they have an accident. You know when it's hit. Murder squad's going up down the freeway.
Where once stood homes for black veterans, there now stands Interstate 70, all 8 to 10 lanes of it.
Mm-hmm. We're in between the railroad tracks and the highway. Now, right now, I'm looking out my kitchen window. I can see the top of the trucks going down the freeway.
Hanford Village is the story of America through the first half of the 20th century. Deeply segregated, but also growing after World War II. A place where black Americans worked hard to create a community of mutual support, where, as Shirley kept telling us, families could thrive. But then, that close-knit community was cleaved by concrete.
In this century, America has become a nation on wheels. We depend on wheels to bring us the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the things we use. But when we depend on wheels, we depend also on highways.
In the mid-1950s, President Dwight D. Eisenhower championed the construction of a 40,000-mile interstate highway system, a hugely ambitious plan that would catapult the nation into the second half of the 20th century, as Eisenhower said in an October 1954 speech given at Cadillac Square in Detroit.
We are pushing ahead with a great road program, a road program that will take this nation out of its antiquated shackles of secondary roads all over this country and give us places, give us the types of highways that we need for this great mass of what it is. It will be a nation of great prosperity, but will be more than that. It will be a nation that's going ahead every day. The expanding horizon is one that staggers the imagination.
Less than 2 years later, June 1956, Eisenhower signed what's popularly known as the National Interstate and Defense Highways Act into law.
They will take the over-the-road driver from city to city, coast to coast, at highway speeds, even through large population centers.
I was starting junior high school. That's when they started the freeway coming through and people were moving.
This is Shirley Mixon again. By the 1960s, she watched how Interstate 70 plowed through the middle of Hanford Village.
It might have been about 20 houses on my street, and it has cut down to 4 houses now. It took the park, half the park, you know, the churches, they moved. It just, I really don't know what to say. You know, it just really, it just messed up the whole neighborhood. And then a lot of people, older people, all of them have gone now.
The highway ultimately eliminated 60 houses and split the community.
I've never seen a community so chopped up into little pieces like Hanford. It's sad to behold.
Jack Marchbanks is the director of the Ohio Department of Transportation. He told local CBS affiliate WBNS that the highway was deliberately routed through Hanford Village, while Bexley, a neighboring, predominantly white and affluent community, remained completely unscathed by the construction of 3 different highways, including I-70, I-71, and I-670.
When you look at where interstates are routed, they are an exact roadmap through the communities that lacked the political power to not have them constructed through those communities. It's a sad fact, but it's a reality that we are dealing with today.
No, they did not. They did not have no say.
Again, Shirley Mixon, lifelong Hanford Village resident.
Well, they had no choice but to do it. Now, one man... He was a retired serviceman, Mr. Robinson, and they weren't giving him hardly nothing for their house.
So, Shirley says, Mr. Robinson picked up his house and moved it. According to federal documents, another resident, so enraged by the displacement and the paltry sum he was being offered for his home, burned down his house instead. Those are just a few examples of how the construction of I-70 destroyed much of community life in Hanford Village 60 years ago. The highway continues to dominate life there today. So much so that when we asked Shirley Mixon to describe how far her house is from I-70, she didn't mentally measure the distance in terms of feet or yards, but in the number of lanes.
From the front door to Allen Creek, let's say maybe 3 lanes of highway, 4 lanes of highway. Does that make sense?
I-70 even governs how she sleeps.
You hear it all day long. I tell you what, I got so used to it that I can tell you something's going wrong. There's no car going down the freeway at night. I'll automatically wake up.
Could there be a next chapter in the story of Hanford Village, or the story of many urban neighborhoods that were divided by highways? Because now, more than ever, activists and urban planners are talking seriously about taking down certain highways, a total sea change in how cities think about transportation. Moreover, the idea now has the support at the highest levels of government. President Joe Biden's $1.7 trillion infrastructure bill contains a proposed $20 billion fund for highway takedowns, or as Biden puts it, to, quote, reconnect neighborhoods.
Too often investments have failed to meet the needs of marginalized communities left behind.
Democrats such as Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen say that the government has a moral obligation to stitch communities back together.
Federal funds created the damage done here, and federal funds should be used to help remedy it.
And in fact, key Republicans do not disagree on the need for change. Their sticking point is who should administer such a program. North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer sits on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee.
Poor planning decisions have led to adverse consequences for specific communities. None of us deny that. And I think we all agree they should be rectified. I believe it should be done at the local and state level where decision makers are closest to the people and able to make a balanced decision.
For now, the fate of Biden's highway takedown fund rests within the larger and very uncertain fate of his overall infrastructure bill. However, the conversation about highways in urban communities is changing. And even that small difference has allowed Shirley Mixon to imagine, even if for a moment, what it would be like if I-70 came down in Hanford Village.
Well, yeah. I sure would and put houses over there, you know. I just wish we had that closeness again.
But Shirley says that's just her dreaming. In reality, even if the highway is torn down, she does not think that what was lost in Hanford Village could ever be restored.
You know, be truthful with you, I don't think so, because time has changed. You know what I'm saying?
And why? Well, Shirley has seen a lot in her 72 years. She's seen a post-war community created and even thrive because Black residents were not welcome elsewhere in Columbus. She's seen that same community get torn apart by highways that were meant to modernize an entire nation. So in short, she's seen how good intentions can go bad. Taking down the highway could be a great thing, but it might also accelerate another process she says is already creeping in Hanford Village, developer and investor-driven gentrification.
People are buying up these houses fast, and they're renting them out, and it's not that close-knit, you know what I'm saying? They want these houses, you know, so I think people would snatch it up, and then you wouldn't be able to afford to live out here.
But that, too, lurks in the fog of an uncertain future. For now, Shirley Mixon says one thing is for sure. She's never leaving Hanford Village.
Well, I'm going to tell you like I tell everybody, I'm going to stay here till the good Lord called me home.
When we come back, we'll have a lot more about what the Biden plan could accomplish and what it fails to do when it comes to highways and reconnecting American neighborhoods. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the growing movement to take down sections of certain highways in American cities and reconnect communities that had been divided by them, particularly communities of color. As we mentioned earlier, the Biden administration is proposing a $15 to $20 billion fund to help facilitate highway removal across the country. So we want to learn more about that fund. What might it accomplish and what it might not accomplish when it comes to reconnecting and revitalizing communities of color. Well, I'm joined today by Deborah Archer. She is National Board President of the ACLU and a professor of clinical law and co-faculty director at the Center for Race, Inequality, and the Law at New York University School of Law. And she recently authored an article in the Vanderbilt Law Review titled White Men's Roads Through Black Men's Homes, Advancing Racial Equity Through Highway Reconstruction. Professor Archer, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, I wanted to start with a quote that you highlight in your paper from the late Congressman John Lewis that he had written in the past, quote, "The legacy of Jim Crow transportation is still with us. Even today, some of our transportation policies and practices destroy stable neighborhoods, isolate and segregate our citizens in deteriorating neighborhoods, and fail to provide access to jobs and economic growth centers." First of all, talk more about that. That's Congressman Lewis's rather insightful and searing indictment of of transportation planning in this country.
Yeah, it really does sum up so much of what we see when it comes to transportation planning across the country, transportation infrastructure and policy have had a profound role in creating and then normalizing patterns of racial segregation and exclusion and economic isolation. And really, race frequently explains which communities receive the benefits of our entire transportation system and which communities were forced to host the burdens, leading to racial disparities and discrimination that were reinforced daily by other transportation policies. So we had an infrastructure that was built in a way that discriminated against communities of color, primarily Black communities. And then we layered on other transportation policies and public transportation that have all just compounded that harm each and every day.
Well, I want to talk more in a minute about the examples of, if I can put it this way, the political infrastructure that enabled that physical infrastructure, as you talk about in your paper. But you also, at the beginning of it, mentioned kind of an interesting irony that I hadn't personally thought about. Because you mentioned that the automobile itself, individually, for individual Black families and the roads upon which they could travel, also provided a sense of, partial emancipation from Jim Crowism. And I do it's an interesting twist I hadn't thought about. Could you just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, you know, Black people have had this really complicated, complex relationship with transportation. So, you know, for decades, using public transportation was a reminder for Black people of their legal and social inferiority, the status that they occupied in this country, particularly in the South, and sitting in the back of the bus, required to give up your seat, separate waiting rooms in transportation facilities, separate bathrooms and drinking fountains. And so in a limited way, the highway and roads and the car presented an opportunity for Black people and other people of color to escape that kind of daily reminders and daily indignities of using more public transportation options. But then, of course, they could not escape discrimination, and racial discrimination followed them onto the roads and into the highways in many different ways.
So it's just I actually really appreciated that you brought that up in your paper, because it shows how the sort of the multiple layers of complexity when we're talking about individual community experience when it comes to racism and infrastructure.
Yeah.
So just to give listeners a sense as to the scale and scope of what we're talking about when we explore how much the construction of the interstate highway system transformed America, you quote a number from the United States Department of Transportation, an estimate that more than 475,000 households, almost a half a million households, and more than a million people nationwide were displaced directly as a result of federal highway building. And you have some particular examples of the impacts of that in communities of color. Could you tell us about the Hill District in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, it was one of many communities where the highway came. And so in certain communities, and hopefully we can talk about this, the highway destroyed a community, just eliminated it entirely as if it was not there anymore. But in other communities, the highway really spared some homes and kind of encircled them and became a wall around those communities, separating them from opportunity, separating them from the benefits of being connected to other communities. So in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, this district known as the Hill District was devastated in order to build Interstate 579. And so when Interstate 579 opened, it effectively cut off the Hill District from Pittsburgh's thriving downtown area, in addition to displacing thousands of Black residents. And the population plummeted from more than 50,000 before the highway was built to less than 10,000 around 2013. And in addition, you lost businesses, community institutions, and parks. And when you do that to a neighborhood, when you cut them off in that way, when you diminish the population, when you eliminate community institutions, you are really, as a local newspaper said when this when they were looking into what happened with the Hill, you kind of damn that community. Mm-hmm. You make it impossible or really, really difficult for the people who live there to thrive, to access opportunity, to feel like they belong in the broader community. And that's what happened to the Hill District, but it happened in so many other communities around the country as well.
Well, and the numbers are quite shocking. Like 400, more than 400 businesses were lost. And as you point out, today, 40% of residents in the Hill District live below the poverty line.
That's
so
right.
Are you directly tying the existence and the construction of I-579 to that outcome that we see today?
So we certainly couldn't say that the highway is solely responsible for what we see in the Hill District community or in other communities. But it certainly did, in my opinion and in my research, set off a series of events that resulted in these communities. Right? It blocked off opportunity, limited access to opportunity outside of the community, inside of the community, and attached a label to these communities, that they were less than, that they weren't worthy of the economic investment, that you could cite other hazardous infrastructure within there. Mm-hmm. So it certainly did play a role. I can't say it's solely responsible. A lot of factors go into creating those communities. But the highway, I think, is a major factor in what happened to that community and to other communities.
Now, you also wanted to talk about communities that were eliminated, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go, tell us about that.
Yeah, because I think it's when you're examining the impact that the interstate highway had on Black communities and other communities of color, I think you have to look at the many ways that it helped to solidify our racially segregated and discriminatory landscape. And that's by serving sometimes as walls, sometimes as a wedge, and sometimes as an extractor in Black communities around the country. And so in terms of it being an extractor, the highways were a tool of removal. And in states around the country, highway construction displaced households, Black households, and really destroyed thriving communities as their homes and churches and schools and businesses were destroyed. And in some of those communities, the highway became the tool that white government officials had been looking for a long time. They had wanted to claim Black neighborhoods. They had wanted to remove Black residents, but lacked the tools because the law prevented other overt forms of discrimination. And this, the highway construction provided not only the tool, but funds and resources to do that. An example is the destruction of a Black community to make way for I-95 in Miami, Florida. And that's an example of how construction of the highway was used to actualize a racial agenda to destroy a vibrant Black community. I-95 tore through the center of Overtown, which was a large and vibrant Black community that was then considered to be the center of economic and cultural life for Black people who were living in Miami. And the destruction of Overtown was the realization of a decades-long campaign by white business leaders and government officials that wanted to remove Black residents and claim that land to expand Miami's central business district. And by the late 1960s, they were successful. And Overtown was dominated by the highway. And there was really no evidence of why it was once called the Harlem of the South. Nearly 40,000 people lived in Overtown before the highway expansion. And shortly after the highway was built, only about 8,000 remained in that community. And it really did devastate them. And that happened again around the country, where the goal was to remove Black communities. Sometimes the excuse was given that they were trying to remove blighted communities, or quote unquote slums. Mm-hmm. Often those communities were nowhere near what anyone would consider to be a blighted community, but that was used as an excuse.
Yeah.
And sometimes they created those conditions.
I think people, it's quite eye-opening, if you don't already know the history, to realize that this isn't just you sort of like putting examples out. Very influential transportation planners were explicit They were explicit about it, even in the way they talked about where they wanted to put the highway. It wasn't a hidden agenda at the time, because you quote, for example, Alfred Johnson, who was executive director of the American Association of State Highway Officials mm-hmm. at the time the Interstate Highway was Act. Highway Act was passed in 1956. I'm not going to read the full quote because it uses a terrible racial epithet, mm-hmm. but he says, paraphrasing, that, quote, some city officials expressed the view in the mid-1950s that the urban interstates would give them a good opportunity to get rid of the local black residents. Mm-hmm. And here he was the head of the American Association of State Highway Officials. You also talk about Robert Moses, the influential public official who, I mean, he's lauded as being one of the visionaries that shaped, you know, urban development in many places across the country. Can you tell us about his mm-hmm. view of how he used infrastructure?
And he certainly did.
Yeah.
He certainly did shape the landscape in New York, where he was responsible for building lots of, you know, kind of roads and parks and beaches. And as a result, there are beautiful things here in New York. But he set an example of how you could do it in use infrastructure to lock in inequality into our physical environment. And we often point to what he did in New York, but he had influence beyond New York and around the country, spreading the word about how infrastructure projects could be tools to lock in inequality and racial segregation, to limit access for people of color to opportunities outside of their communities. And we often point to Robert Moses and act as if he was the only one who was doing this. Mm. But as you said, it was done around the country. And some of the timing is that civil rights litigation was helping to challenge a lot of the traditional tools of racial segregation, including things like racial zoning laws. And so some communities, although they spared a lot of black homes, they still used the highway as a tool to advance a segregationist agenda. And they erected these post-Jim Crow walls that separated white and black communities and protected, they believed, white people from black migration. And they were assisted by existing racial segregation patterns and the racial zoning laws so that they were able to sometimes just build the highway right on the previously formal or informal boundary line between white and black neighborhoods. And in that way, they were able to confine black residents. And they didn't hide it. They announced that this was their intention in Atlanta. They announced that Interstate 20 was intended to be the boundary between white and black communities. Sometimes white communities requested changes to the highway routes so that they could feel more comfortable that it would serve as a boundary. Mm. That happened in Orlando, Florida, where they built a highway separating black residents and white residents in the Central Business District because white residents fared integration asked to have this done.
Can I just stick with Robert Moses here for one mm-hmm. more second? Because, I mean, the examples that you provide in your paper are remarkable, and not in a good way.
Right? No.
but you know, because you say that Robert Moses, for example, let me see if I can find the right reference. Yes, that he instructed engineers to build bridges across the Southern State Parkway deliberately with 1 foot less clearance than bridges on Hutchinson Sawmill and Bronx River Parkways. Can you just briefly tell us why that was? Why that 1 foot less clearance made all the difference?
Yeah, and so that was his biographer reports that he did that to lock in the inequality, even if we had saw continual progress on civil rights laws, that he wanted to have a way to lock in inequality that would outlive mm-hmm. any kind of evolution in civil rights laws. And that he said that legislation can always be changed, because at that point, the parkways already restricted trucks and buses from accessing those parkways. And he wanted to make sure that buses couldn't access the parkways because he believed that that was the way that Black and Puerto Rican New Yorkers were most likely to use to access the beaches that he was helping to build. So he wanted to make sure that they had difficulty getting to the beaches. And if they couldn't use the parkways, they would have to use secondary roads, and that would make the trip really long and hard. And so hopefully they wouldn't come. And he believed that despite the fact that there was already legislation in place at that time, that legislation could be changed. But it was going to be hard to tear down the bridge once it was up. And that's also kind of the sentiment that goes through so much of infrastructure. Hmm. It's hard to tear down a highway when it's already up and the damage is done.
Well, but we may be at least the beginnings of a turning point, because the useful life of many of these highways, we're near the end of it, which is why in some, at least 30 cities, according to some experts, are considering taking down sections of highways to re-knit the very communities we have been talking about. So we'll discuss that more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the new conversation around taking down highways in many American cities. According to one analysis, at least 30 cities across the United States are considering taking down portions of highways that run through neighborhoods that wrecked those neighborhoods, particularly communities of color, and are examining whether removing those highways can revitalize and re-knit those communities. In addition, the Biden administration has proposed a $15 to $20 billion fund that would assist cities that are either looking into or taking down sections of highways in communities. And so we're taking a look at what such a fund might accomplish and what it doesn't do. I'm joined today by Deborah Archer. She's national board president of the ACLU and a professor of law as well at New York University. And she's written extensively about highway construction and the impact it has had on communities of color for more than 60 years in this country. Her article appeared in the Vanderbilt Law Review, and it's titled White Men's Roads Through Black Men's Homes, Advancing Racial Equity Through Highway Reconstruction. Professor Archer, before we get to kind of putting ourselves in a solutions mindset here, I do also want to ask you about your legal analysis here, because you mentioned a little bit earlier that a couple of decades or a decade or so after we saw the major push of the 40,000 miles of interstate being constructed across the United States, that in fact, because activists were pushing back about the effects it was having on their communities, Congress enacted some legislation to slow that devastation. They wanted to protect parks, historic districts, environmentally sensitive areas. Mm-hmm. But you say that none of that legislation, or very little of it, actually helped protect communities of color. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think the legislation reflects what we saw during the highway revolts and when communities started to push back. Communities pushed back for various reasons, and communities were often more successful if they linked their battle to environmental protection and protecting historical neighborhoods, and less successful when their struggles and their battle was linked to racial justice and the racial justice concerns. And so we see that reflected in the legislation that followed those highway revolts. And yes, the legislation that Congress passed, I think, was really helpful in shaping how we move forward in many ways. That legislation protected environmentally sensitive areas, historical neighborhoods, required some assistance for relocation. But it wasn't focused on racial justice, and it certainly was not focused on trying to reverse the harm, stop the harm that was going on in impacted communities of color.
And I don't actually see a lot of evidence that there was, until recently, the idea that reversing the harm would require resources as well, right?
That's right. Reversing, there's a lot of damage, so it's going to require a lot of resources to reverse the harm that was done. And we have not seen that kind of focus and investment. It is not just about tearing down highways. It's about trying to address the lasting impact of highway development, the full spectrum of impact and harm that communities have been forced to live with for decades now.
You also point out, though, that the Civil Rights Act itself doesn't provide adequate protection for a very specific reason. Why is that?
I think there are lots of challenges with the way that our civil rights laws are currently interpreted and applied. One is the focus on intentional discrimination and how you prove intentional discrimination. Courts don't often look at this kind of broader contextual evidence of intentional discrimination. We tend to focus on kind of individual harms and not the harms to entire communities and what's gone on with entire communities. And we also have a focus on trying to be race blind and race neutral. And this kind of harm was focused on a racial impact. And our solutions have to also be focused on remedying that racial impact. And so I don't think that race neutral or race blind solutions or approaches are going to help. And unfortunately, that's the way that courts are interpreting our current civil rights laws.
And I mean, just to echo back to our exploration of what Robert Moses says, it seems to me, and I think you write about this in the paper, that the Civil Rights Act, it becomes most muscular in what it can do after a decision has been made.
That's right.
After the decision to build something has been made. But you're calling for the kind of the thinking that you just described to happen well before the first block of concrete is poured.
And yes, well, our civil rights laws really do often kick in to challenge a decision once it's been made, to challenge harm once that harm has been begun to be experienced by individuals or communities. And with these highways, we really need to intervene at a point before momentum is behind a plan. We need to think about how we are protecting impacted communities long before, not just long before the concrete is poured, long before a plan has solidified, so that we can consider racial justice issues and make them central to our considerations of how we move forward from beginning to end.
You know, I just want to emphasize that this isn't a conversation, and even nationwide, it's not a conversation about just getting rid of highways. It is also a fact, and you acknowledge this in the paper, that the construction of the interstate highway system did actually serve to radically modernize the nation, and then at a broad level to the benefit of the United States and, ironically, stitch together parts of the country. So really, the question is now, how can we be most thoughtful in what happens to the existing highway infrastructure, because it is reaching the end of its useful life, and where, if new highways are going to be built, where and how they're going to be built. And look, we have a lot of response coming in online from listeners who live in various parts of the country that have endured this. For example, if I can just read for a second, Carolyn Ann Gritter says, when we moved to Boston's South End in 1967, it was mostly African-American, unempowered, and politically unempowered, which allowed perfectly good Victorian row houses to be torn down. The planning geniuses and elected officials called it, quote, urban renewal instead of what it was. We were part of a fight against a highway that was to be located where the Southwest Corridor Park is now. Defeating the ill-conceived plan saved the South End, a soon-to-be state and federal landmark. But she goes on and says, as it is, the Massachusetts Turnpike runs like an ugly scar through historic neighborhoods, separating communities, diminishing their quality of life. Mm-hmm. And you know, given that I am actually located here in Boston, I will note that the South End is an amazing neighborhood, but it's also undergone radical gentrification yeah. as well over the past several decades. But let's focus for a second on a place where a portion of highway has actually been removed and the community's involvement there and what the community would still like to see happen. So we spoke with Sean Dunwoody, an artist and community activist based in Rochester, New York. Like I-70 that we mentioned at the beginning of the show that runs through Hanford Village in Columbus, Ohio, Rochester has long been divided by a section of I-490 that created a loop around the downtown area that's known as the Inner Loop. Now, Dunwoody grew up in Rochester, and he says that inside of that loop, downtown was developing with new coffee shops, yoga studios, and loft apartments.
But the other side, where predominantly people of color were, there were no buildups. There were no new developments. Houses were being torn down. They're empty lots. You have someone who lives in a $600,000 home and someone on the other side, 300 feet away, living in a $45,000 home.
In 2012, Rochester, the city of Rochester, secured a $17 million grant to remove the eastern section of the loop. And by 2014, the city secured an additional $23.6 million needed to start reconstruction there. The removal was completed in 2017. But Dunwoody says that while tearing down that section of the freeway marked a start, he looks around at the tall buildings that filled up the space and made the new neighborhood far from accessible, actually, from those on the outside of the loop.
We've got these large blocks of just, you know, apartments. And to some folks who are living, once again, not too far away on the other side of the Inner Loop, are looking at it as it is high end and we cannot afford it. And so you're trying to push us out of this area. So you have to actually look at that, too.
And since 2018, Dunwoody and his activist organization, Hinge Neighbors, have worked with the city of Rochester, trying to make sure that the community's needs and opinions are heard.
You have to really consider not just filling in this moat, but what are the ripple effects on the streets that are four, five, six, a block and a half away? How do you actually help and support those neighborhoods as well? They're now understanding they have to be engaged in the process. So now the consultants and the city are going out and listening to people. It's really about having a connected community, a culturally connected community. And I hope that, you know, 20 years from now, folks don't even remember or even think about this highway that went through their backyards, but understand the stories of those families lost. But know now we can correct some of those wrongs that were done in the past.
That's Sean Dunwoody of Rochester, New York. Professor Deborah Archer, respond to what you hear about what's been going on over the past several years in Rochester in their attempts mm-hmm. to remove the highway and re-knit the community.
Yeah, what we just heard about going on in Rochester is also going on in Syracuse. It is reflected in so many communities that have been engaged in takedown or redevelopment projects around the country and have not seen the kind of transformational return in communities of color that people hope for. I think, as communities engage in projects of highway redevelopment, racial equity, focusing on repairing racialized harm and advancing racial justice in both process and outcome has to be central. If we're not focused on that, we're going to see mm-hmm. some of the challenges that Mr. Dunwoody just described of gentrification, of exclusion, of people who have worked and strived and lived in these communities for decades, then being priced out, being pushed out. We have risks of temporary and permanent dislocation. So we have to focus on rebuilding these communities in a way that supports the ability of those who have lived there for decades to continue to live there, to enjoy the benefits of this economic reinvestment. I think it has to include a focus on housing. Laws and policies and programs that support homeowners and renters and their ability to stay as the nature of the community changes. We also have to make sure that we have long-term sustained investment in small businesses mm-hmm. so that they can also continue to be a part of the community.
Yeah. Do you know what's so fascinating to me about this issue of transportation and highways? And that is, by definition, nothing about them can be accidental, right? Mm-hmm. It has to be planned from the start. Now, granted, sort of a community, there is an organic process in terms of how a community evolves or devolves, as we talked about, after major infrastructure mm-hmm. goes in or is taken down. But it seems to me that there is a great opportunity in the fact that it has to be planned. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about focusing on racial equity, can you give me some, you know, a few more specific examples on how that might be accomplished in the planning of the highway removals that mm-hmm. cities are considering?
Yeah, and it does have to be planned, and it's not a plan that takes place over, 1 year. Mm-hmm. Highway projects, it's a decade-long project, and the planning begins long before we see any results. And so one way is to involve community members from the very beginning in that planning. And that does not mean just listening to what community members have to say, because we're not going to see the kind of results that we want to see if there's not a shift in power and we're empowering community members to say what their community needs. What do they need and what's going to be best and how we move forward. I think it's a challenge that we don't focus on how to address kind of entrenched inequality and just focus on moving forward. So moving forward, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. But that doesn't address all of the harms that have been inflicted on this community over decades and how it has entrenched the inequality. We have to focus on housing. Mm-hmm. And making sure that we're rebuilding businesses and building affordable housing right. so that people can and stay and are not driven out of their homes.
So you write about a specific idea about a racial impact statement for highway projects. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. And it's one of the ways I think that we can focus on racial equity from beginning to end. When adopted, racial equity impact studies or statements, as they're sometimes called, can be a powerful tool for understanding how past, present, and proposed systems contribute to racial inequality. And it forces government agencies to think about this complicated web of considerations that we were talking about. And these types of studies have been used or proposed in various contexts to reform racialized institutions and structures, including our criminal legal system. And I think that they could be really powerful tools here if federal, state, and local agencies planning highway redevelopment projects had to complete multi-agency, multi-domain, and regionally focused racial equity impact studies prior to developing and implementing their plans to really systematically analyze how racial and ethnic groups are going to be affected to address a wide variety of racialized harms right. that continue to be systemic and pervasive.
It seems to me, though, I'm feeling optimistic because at least, you know, seeing the glimmer of hope, because there's mm-hmm. this conversation, nationally, has been growing over the past few years, and perhaps we are at the beginning of a turning point about rethinking the impact or understanding the impact of highway construction on so many communities of color in the mm-hmm. United States. So Deborah Archer, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. Deborah Archer is National Board President of the ACLU and a professor of law at New York University. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is On Point.